2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com, follow us on Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
Dave and Dejanovic, your morning companions for talk, analysis, and key perspectives on Utah's biggest stories on KSL News Radio.
If you were with us yesterday, you know that during our show it was five high schools that these hoax threats were creating chaos at. By Jeff Kaplan's show yesterday afternoon, it was up to 13 Utah schools, just all across Utah. And now I want to go smack dab into the middle of the investigation, Dave, into whodunit.
I don't know what a better word is. Hoax makes it kind of sound like it was fun. But when we started talking to people that went through it, that actually saw the police officers going door to door with their long guns into these classrooms and the terror and the fear and the tears. Hoax is a terrible word, but I don't know what the better word is.
You mean like this?
It was kind of a lack of information at first. So we kind of just went into it blindly. We actually had to hide in our wood shop and we were just there waiting for any info, whether that be police coming in or whether that be someone else. You know, you don't know what's happening in there. So
it's 9:08. It's time for the launch.
Sequence engaged.
And here are three things that Debbie wants you to know.
Countdown. Three.
We have got a big show lined up, and we've got this story covered end to end. What is ATAC? It's Area Tactical Analysis Center at OPD, at the Ogden Police Department. Think of it as a nerve center at OPD, tapping into hundreds of cameras, and in fact, gave them a virtual view inside Ogden High as this active shooter, this fake threat, was unfolding. We're going to take you inside the center with the center's director. He's calling the show in 45 minutes.
ATAC had eyes inside the school on multiple camera feeds. So we had analysts that were in our center supplying real-time information, describing over the radio what they saw.
Ogden is unique. Ogden has invested in cameras and this kind of technology for years. And it seems like this was a perfect opportunity, and they used it very well. And they realized, I think, early on that this was not a real threat. They couldn't see anything happening. And that was powerful.
Countdown to...
Let's talk about the punishment for pulling off a hoax directed at schools. One word. Prison. Mm-hmm. We're going to dive into investigations of previous hoax threats against schools and what became of the hoaxers. Many of them teenagers, in fact, 18, 19 years old. In fact, here's a college student. I found this. It's a public service announcement posted on the FBI's national website. This guy got busted, and he's now part of that PSA.
I got arrested by the FBI, and now I don't know what my future looks like. I search my name on the web almost every day and look at the stuff. It's not going away.
And like I said, we call it a hoax and it sounds fun. And maybe the people that are doing this think it is funny. But think of the millions of dollars that must have been wasted yesterday in time, effort, energy, resources for a hoax. Now, the other side of it, maybe it wasn't meant to be funny. Or wasn't meant to be a prank. Maybe it really was malicious.
Launch countdown one.
Right, here's what we know as we take you inside the investigation. The Utah investigators are saying they've connected the hoax to an IP address from out of the country. and to a male. So we're going to ask the Utah Department of Public Safety. They're calling the show in about 9 minutes. Is arrest of a suspect in sight for the hoaxes that created chaos in 13 Utah schools?
There were rumors flying, right? There were people saying I heard shots and parents saying that my kid said this, and people get talking and saying things that aren't true, and that just creates more problems for everybody.
And maybe even a little panic for the kids that were experiencing this, for the adults, the teachers, not knowing what is going on. Now, the fact that they were able to track down the IP address, narrow it down to a single individual, that's incredible, in a matter of hours.
Dave and Janovic.
The launch.
Commence.
Weber Dispatch received a 911 call indicating there was an active shooter at Ogden High School on Harrison Boulevard in Ogden. That caller reported that there were shots fired and several students were down and injured by gunfire. At some point during this clearing of the school, we learned that this was a hoax.
All right, it was a hoax, but obviously Exhibit 1 is those phone calls that either went into the dispatch centers or came from the schools. We're going to take you right inside the middle of this investigation over the next hour.
Joining us now, KSL legal analyst Greg Skordas. Greg, we'll talk to investigators in about 10 minutes, maybe a little less, but it seems like only a matter of time before this person gets caught.
Well, we certainly hope so, Dave. And there's actually both federal and state charges that would apply here. If the caller used the internet, that's federal crime. And just calling into a state school or a state agency or anything like that is a state crime. And this person will almost certainly be prosecuted in both venues because under the law, there's enough distinction between the two crimes that they could be. And it doesn't even matter, Dave, that the person couldn't carry out the threat. If you say there's I planted a bomb in the school, even if you don't have a bomb, even if you have no ability to make a bomb, you've committed the crime. And it can be up to a second degree felony in Utah, which is punishable by up to 15 years in prison. The feds have a 5-year prison sentence on there. So we're talking about some pretty serious crimes that will hopefully be charged to get someone here.
I want to expand on the conversation I heard yesterday at Jeff Kaplan's show in the afternoon. He had retired FBI Special Agent Greg Rogers in on the conversation. And he told Jeff yesterday, well, let me just play this.
The crime is committed within the United States, so it can still be prosecuted here. It can still be investigated here. And he can be charged here.
So let's play what if for a moment, Greg. If this person is indeed out of the country and not just spoofing technology to make it look that way, FBI agent Greg Rogers retired now, but says that there's no doubt a person could still be charged and criminally prosecuted in the U.S. What are your thoughts?
Oh, no question. The crime was, no matter where the individual was, if the crime happened here, which it did, and the action was meant to cause fear here, then Utah would certainly have jurisdiction, and the feds would have jurisdiction. Of course, we hope that the individual is in a country that has an extradition treaty with the United States, because some countries don't, and they can hide that individual or at least prevent him or her from being extradited to the United States. But those countries are few and far between.
I would assume some of those would be Russia, China, et cetera.
Right. And some countries that just don't, people hide out in certain countries that don't have extradition treaties with the United States. But people mess up, Dave. People travel, they go here and there. They don't realize that these warrants are going to be active for the rest of their lives. And ultimately, my guess is this individual is going to be brought to the United States, to Utah, and be prosecuted.
KSL legal analyst Greg Skordas, thank you.
Next, let's continue our dive into the middle of this investigation. We're going to get a live phone call from the Department of Public Safety. Their investigators are on the case. The FBI is on the case. The local police department's on the case to catch the mystery person who caused the chaos.
And they said, you know, who's in there? And they asked us, have you heard any of the shots? Do you know where the shooter is? And then everybody started panicking.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.
Dave and DeGenovic. Dave and DeGenovic. Special coverage of the top local story.
And they said, you know, who's in there? And they asked us, have you heard any of the shots? Do you know where the shooter is? And then everybody started panicking.
That's the theater teacher from Spanish Fork High, Andy Hunsaker. Him and the thousands of others who were impacted all over Utah yesterday. This conversation is for you. We're going to speak live with the Department of Public Safety to find out where they're at in this mystery whodunit. Who called in the hoax? When will they make an arrest?
It was calm to chaos inside of those schools yesterday. Local police teaming up with state police and the FBI to try to unravel the mystery into who caused this.
There were rumors flying, right? There were people saying I heard shots and parents saying that my kid said this and people get talking and saying things that aren't true. And that just creates more problems for everybody.
Yeah, the kids were hiding under their desks. Parents obviously are starting to panic because their kids are immediately texting them. We're in lockdown. Apparently there's a shooter, right? Can you imagine getting that text? You don't know if it's a hoax or not. You wouldn't automatically think, oh, that's not really happening.
Hillary Kellner, a Utah Department of Public Safety Director of Communications, live on the line with us right now. Let's walk through what we know so far about these phone calls. Hillary, is the working theory, I read this morning on KSLTV.com, still that it's a male. It traces to just one IP address that actually traced to somewhere outside the country. Is that where investigators are at right now, still this morning?
Yes. So currently what we were able to find is that all of the calls were made from the same phone number. And as our statewide information and analysis center, along with the FBI, investigated to trace this number, they found that it connected to an IP address that was connecting to outside of the country, not to one specific country. That IP address kind of tagged a couple of different countries. Yet that doesn't necessarily mean that person is outside of the country as well, right? Unfortunately, some of the things that come with technology, as great as it is that people can mask IP address multiple times.
Can you describe the phone call for me? Was this a voicemail that was left? Did they call into the offices? How did this phone call go? And then was it an actual voice? Was it a recording? Was that voice accented? Was it distinguishable?
We were able to recognize that it was a male individual with a foreign accent. And they called 911. That's how we were able to get some of the information from the CAD, which is where we are able to, you know, as law enforcement, everybody kind of can tune into the radio, and especially the local law enforcement is notified. And that's where we were able to see the notes about specifically in the Spanish Fork scenario, that there was an active shooter, that there were about, I believe, six people wounded, and the caller was hiding in the bathroom. So this was not true. As we found out, the local departments were not able to find any evidence that any of these calls were true. Therefore, that's why we made the announcement that they were a hoax, because parents were, as you mentioned at the beginning, right? They were getting stuff from their children. The children were getting stuff from other people in the school. Social media kind of started going a little bit crazy with a couple of different theories on what could be happening or what was happening. So we just wanted to make sure that people were somewhat at ease knowing that their kids were safe and that there was not an active shooter.
Going inside the investigation into the hoax active shooter threats at multiple schools across Utah yesterday, where things stand right now with the Utah Department of Public Safety. We know local law enforcement is involved, as well as the FBI. Hillary Kellner, the Director of Communications with DPS, on the line with us live. I'm wondering if investigators feel that the individual read from a script and all of these calls into the different 911 centers sounded word for word the same, or was it a live just somebody who was randomly calling and just kind of saying different things at different 911 centers, Hillary?
For the 13 schools that we've confirmed so far in the state of Utah that were claimed to have an active shooter situation, we know that the storyline was pretty similar with all of them, yet they were not exactly the same, but the individual did seem to use the same storyline for most.
How, close are we to an arrest? Is this something that will be extremely difficult? Is there a thought that this person does live in the United States or is truly living somewhere else outside of the U.S.?
We currently don't have that information. Our state investigative team, as well as the FBI, are looking into this. And we do know that other states had similar scenarios yesterday as well. So we are all collaborating in our efforts here locally, as well as with other partners in different states.
And that was going to be my follow-up question. As we look at Massachusetts, they had multiple schools going through the same thing. I believe it was on Tuesday. Also Pennsylvania dealing with the same type of phone calls. Any indication as to why these different states were chosen, including Utah, and in the sites of this caller at all? And also, are they all these cases connected across the nation?
Currently, we don't know, or at least I don't have that information. But what we do know is that at least for the 13 schools in the state of Utah, it was the same individual, the same number, and the same IP address.
Are you at all concerned about a cry wolf scenario where maybe next time a phone call like this comes in, that the reaction isn't as aggressive as it was yesterday?
Definitely not. There is complete confidence in our law enforcement entities here in the state of Utah, as I'm sure many people saw, and even throughout social media. I think that the perception that we were able to see is that our teams are ready to answer to any kind of accusation of this kind, right? If it were real, they will answer every time and take it very seriously to make sure that people are safe, because public safety is the number one priority for all of law enforcement in the state.
Hillary Kellner from the Department of Public Safety, Director of Communications. Thank you so much for communicating all of this information to our listeners, getting us inside that investigation. Our team of reporters and producers in the newsroom right now, keeping in touch with DPS and other law enforcement agencies. Minute something breaks on this, our listeners will be the first to know.
I think my concern would be if something like this happens again, I like the response that we had, where you send everybody there, right? I mean, it's red alert, hit the red button, everybody shows up. Because if this starts becoming commonplace and you have police or 911 calling to verify, these are valuable minutes that are lost. I think our reaction was great. It was swift. It was forceful. And we have to continue to do this. We can't just assume that these phone calls are hoaxes.
Okay, so my curiosity has piqued on how in the world law enforcement is actually able to track down an IP address so quickly to one individual, all to the same. But yet it sounds like what we just heard from DPS, that it was skipping like to different countries. So let's get our tech expert, Earl Foote, into the conversation. to teach us more about how in the world this happens and how law enforcement was able to hone in on one male so quickly after yesterday's chaos.
I'm going to hopefully be okay. It might be a little tough because something could happen again. But where it was just a hoax and they did take precaution, I'm okay with coming back tomorrow.
Dave and DeGenovic. Dave and DeGenovic. Special coverage of the top local story.
All of the calls were made from the same phone number, and as our statewide information and analysis center, along with the FBI, investigated to trace this number, they found that it connected to an IP address that was connecting to outside of the country, not to one specific country. That IP address kind of tagged a couple of different countries. Yet that doesn't necessarily mean that that person is outside of the country.
We just hung up the phone a few minutes ago with the director of communications for the Department of Public Safety. They are part of this widespread investigation that involves local police departments and the FBI as well to track down the person, the mystery caller, who created chaos at 13 different schools yesterday with the hoax call of an active shooter.
And I think initially I was excited when I heard they tracked the IP address outside of the country. But as we just learned, it sounded like it was kind of bouncing from spot to spot to spot. So obviously they were using some sort of computer program to scramble the signal. Is there any useful information that they can pull from that? We thought we'd talk to an expert about this because, listen, we don't know how it all works, but my guess is Earl Foote from Nexus IT does. Earl, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. This is a disturbing situation, and I certainly feel bad for the schools and the students and all the parents involved, that were alarmed yesterday. As you heard, any phone call, whether that be an analog or digital phone call, can be traced. And your listeners are probably asking, what is an IP address? An IP address is a digital address. You can think of it like a street address. It identifies networks, servers, computers, and other devices that reside on the public internet. It has been the fact that this has been traced, the phone number has been traced to an IP address, would tell us that these were digital calls or voice over IP phone calls. IP addresses are assigned on a per country or block of country basis. Law enforcement pretty quickly can say, okay, this IP address is assigned to a specific country or a block of countries. There are also tools that will help you actually geolocate an IP address, the origination point, even at times down to the accuracy of a street address. Now there's a lot of the previous caller mentioned some nuances, and there's a significant kind of path ahead for law enforcement to really whittle down to figure out, if they can identify who this caller was and where that call came from. And the reason I say that is that they, just because you have an IP address, you don't have a smoking gun. More experienced cyber criminals, they will either tunnel to or connect to a server, like a voice over IP server, where they're making such phone calls from a different location, a different country, potentially around the globe. The other thing to keep in mind is that IP addresses and MAC addresses can be spoofed, so they can be faked. Even the male voice that was heard could be spoofed by AI or bots. But the good news is that if the perpetrator has registered an account with a cloud service provider to create a voice over IP phone server, that cloud provider potentially has contact information for that person. Now, obviously, if they're a smart criminal, they're going to cover their tracks and they're going to provide bogus information, right? Mm-hmm. All that being said, they're partially the way through, figuring out who this might be. But there is a significant amount of work to be done to to figure out if they can actually whittle it down to an accurate source.
Earl Foote with Nexus IT helping us walk through what lies ahead for investigators as they try to track down the mystery caller who put 13 schools on high alert with an active shooter hoax threat yesterday. And I'm wondering, Earl, what you feel are the odds that this person is actually operating from within the United States, and actually spoofing that they're from out of the country. That's a real possibility as well, correct?
It absolutely is, particularly given the fact that specific geographies were targeted, and there might be, there might be motive on the part of the perpetrator that involves those geographies, which may lean to, and look, I'm not a behavioral scientist and I won't pretend to be a profiler, right? But it may lean to the source being within the United States or somebody with, specific knowledge of the geolocalities to where the phone calls were placed. So it's entirely possible. It's also, in today's information age and a digital world, it's entirely possible that that call could have come from an island in the Pacific Ocean, that's quite unknown, right?
Earl Foote.
Well
Thank
said,
you.
Earl.
I hope that's not where we have to go to extradite in the middle of nowhere. Earl Foote with the Nexus IT. Thank you. And it can be daunting, Deb. I mean, it's just strange. Like, if this really did come from out of the country, bad actors looking to sow chaos in America, why Utah? Right? Of all the places to do this, Utah is such a strange location to choose if there is no tie here.
Well, if we don't know more information about an arrest during our show, I know for sure Maria and Jeff Kaplan will be all over the latest developments throughout the day. Straight ahead, we're going to go inside the nerve center at Ogden PD. It certainly piqued my attention as we were watching the news conference at noon yesterday unfold after OPD had determined that there was no valid threat inside Ogden High School. There's this center that has monitors, and it's all tapped into cameras all over the place in the northern part of our state. Here's what we heard yesterday.
ATAC had eyes inside the school on multiple camera feeds. So we had analysts that were in our center supplying real-time information, describing over the radio what they saw.
Ooh, let's go inside ATAC next.
Dave and Dujanovic. Special coverage of the top local story.
Not only did we have a SWAT officer on scene performing a tactical operation of what he's been trained to do, we also had our Area Tactical Analysis Center, what we refer to as ATAC, had eyes inside the school on multiple camera feeds. So we had analysts that were in our center supplying real-time information, describing over the radio what they saw.
OPD with a virtual view inside Ogden High School as the active shooter threat, although it turned out to be a hoax, was unfolding. Not only did they have a school resource officer, Dave, who had been trained in these types of scenarios, they had cameras. And that's not the only place they have cameras that are piped into the ATAC.
Yeah, Ogden has been a very interesting city. They've invested in cameras, in this technology, and they've done this for years. It really paid dividends yesterday when they were able to try to confirm whether or not there really was a shooter in the school, because they have so many cameras and they're not seeing anything. And their officer, who's just one person trying to go through this very large school, you needed all of these resources to finally come to the conclusion that this was not really an active shooter situation. This was a hoax.
Let's bring David Wheeloth, the director of OPD's Area Tactical Analysis Center, into the conversation. I want to continue down the road of the conversation you and I were having, David, before the show about the benefit to being able to see inside that school. You said Deb gave us just a virtual view, and we could see that there was no active shooter. Talk about that.
Absolutely. And thank you for having this morning. We're happy to support our partners in the media. We entered into an agreement with the Ogden City School District several years ago to give us access to the live feeds inside the schools. And as unfortunate it is, this is part of our reality now. So when this call came in, one of the analysts immediately pulls up the camera feeds from this school and begins going through all the different view sheds looking for anything that's going to help the officers who are responding. We're monitoring the radio traffic, so we knew that the school resource officer was inside the building. He was on campus when the call came in, and he's already starting to clear the part of the campus he's in. But what we were seeing, or what we weren't seeing, were any activities that would support what the caller had claimed. We aren't seeing panicked people running through the building. We didn't see, obviously, anyone with weapons. And so to give us that advantage to be virtually inside the building when the call came in is tremendous in these types of situations.
As you are monitoring these video feeds, how do you communicate with officers in the field?
So all of the analysts have radios. They have been trained in that type of communication. But in this type of scenario, airtime is at a premium. So there's not a lot of chit-chat going on. We held off in most of our communications only if we had seen something. That's the point in time when we need to say, this is where you need to go. This is where the problem is. At one point, officers on the scene were being provided keys by the school staff to get into areas of the school that were locked. The swimming pool and I believe the automotive shop were on that list. We could already see inside those two locations with the camera feeds and knew from what we could see there was no problem occurring there.
David Wheeloth is the director of Ogden Police Department's Area Tactical Analysis Center. Think of it as a nerve center with lots of monitors that have access to hundreds of cameras. Having visited the center in the past, David, it's been a few years since I've been in there. It is impressive. And cameras and monitors can be switched between cameras. I went to the city's website to learn more about this or get myself an update about how many cameras the OPD has access to at any given time. And the website says 600 city-owned cameras, 600 private cameras are owned by private businesses, 1,500 cameras in the Weber School District. And obviously you had a view into Ogden High School yesterday, but this is a network of hundreds of cameras that OPD has access to at any one time.
Correct. Now, to clarify, a lot of the city-owned cameras are installed to protect city assets. So of that 600 plus or minus count, some of those are in a server room in the basement of the municipal building.
I see.
So the majority of those are not overly beneficial for us, but we do have cameras in a lot of the public places down around the municipal building where our amphitheater is, and down along our throughout the business district. We have a number of parking lots for our trailheads along the east bench. So to have cameras there is very beneficial if we have an incident up there. We can go and access the recordings, or if it's an unfolding event like what happened yesterday, look at the live views and communicate to the first responders who are on site or who are responding to help them respond more safely and more efficiently. We don't own the school cameras. We have a partnership with the Ogden City School District and the Weber County School District to access those live feeds for these types of events.
How common is it to have an ATAC?
For an agency our size, it's not very common. You see these types of facilities in more an NFL-sized city. But we've been in operation for almost 12 years now and provide a number of different resources and expertise to our department and beyond. We're a regional asset. We don't just provide services to the Ogden Police Department. Any law enforcement entity that needs our support, we're open to that.
But there isn't one in, say, Salt Lake or in Utah County?
Salt Lake City has crime analysts. I don't believe, I may be mistaken, that they have a true dedicated crime center like the one we've set up. The SIAC, the Statewide Information and Analysis Center, they're very similar to what we're doing, but have a different mission.
I would imagine on a day like yesterday, when you've got a virtual view from the police department, being able to tap into those cameras at Ogden High, ATAC gets an A++. But on other days, I'm sure it's gotten some pushback from people who feel like Big Brother's watching them all the time.
Absolutely.
You've heard both sides of this, I'm sure.
Correct. And we're open to scrutiny. We have a lot of very strict controls regarding when we can access a particular system. We're careful to document, for example, our license plate reader database. Why did we run a query through that system? For one, there are only a handful of people within the department. It's only within the ATAC that they can query a plate against that system. So we don't have blanket access by everyone on the department. We want to remember that with any resource, there is room for abuse, and we don't want that to happen. We want to use it, and we are using it for the right reasons.
David Wheeloff, Director of Ogden Police Department's Area Tactical Analysis Center. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah. In the 10 o'clock hour, we're going to take a deep dive into the app that Spanish Fork High football coach, who called the show yesterday, Dustin Smith, was talking about as this event was unfolding. He said that the school district or the school had just downloaded an app to help coordinate these types of incidences, ironically, like a week ago. So we're going to get more information on that app in the 10 o'clock hour.
Yeah, I think you're seeing some creativity from schools, school districts, cities, you know, the police departments, trying to figure out the best way for modern policing, because we have a lot of technology, we have a lot of ability to communicate with folks, but sometimes you have so much technology and so many apps that it can be overwhelming and you're not quite sure how to use it.
As we head into our 10 o'clock hour, I want to leave you with the latest information from the Department of Public Safety on their investigation into the hoax threats.
All of the calls were made from the same phone number, and as our Statewide Information and Analysis Center, along with the FBI, investigated to trace this number, they found that it connected to an IP address that was connecting to outside of the country, not to one specific country. That IP address kind of tagged a couple of different countries. Yet that doesn't necessarily mean that person is outside of the country.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news. Utah's Water Watch, special coverage on KSL News Radio.
So we're not quite to the point where we can say, yeah, we got the most snow in Utah history yet, but it is the wettest snow in Utah history. I think, of course, this means we're going to be able to squeeze more water out of these hundreds of inches of snow, so much more than we've ever had in the past. So this is good news. Of course, the Debbie Downer moment is always when we start talking about the concerns for flooding. In fact, we had Clint Meekum, the Salt Lake County Emergency Management Director, on the line with us just a couple of days ago about the possibilities.
So the creeks that we're always concerned about are Big and Little Cottonwood, Mill Creek, Parley's Creek, City Creek, Red Butte Creek, and again, those that we've had historical runoff issues with, 83, 2010, 2011.
95% of our water comes from our snowpack. Thanks, DNR. I just learned that. It's not just that the snowpack melts and finds its way into the rivers, though, that we should be concerned about. It's the water, though, that seeps into the ground and saturates it and changes the water table. And the reason I know that is because I talked to Kevin Eubank the other day, and he started talking about groundwater and water tables. Especially if you've built a home recently, this is something you need to be aware of.
Hi, Kev. Are you there? Oh, are we going to get him on? Okay. Well, Kevin Eubank is supposed to be on the line with us, and hopefully he calls in the show any moment now, because he was talking to us yesterday about groundwater and the idea of it coming up from the ground and potentially flooding basements, which is something I had not thought about. And it made me wonder if I needed to be more in tune with buying flood insurance. And I know you kind of like, oh, it's insurance for this and it's insurance for that. But there's certain areas that he pointed out across the Wasatch Front that have been recently developed, or at least since, you know, the last several years,
yeah,
that could be more at risk for groundwater coming up.
Well, it's fair because, you know, when you look at some of these new builds, we've been in the middle of a drought and restrictions. Maybe they didn't take this into account when they were making these new homes or building these new homes. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Hey, you bet, guys.
All right. We're diving into this groundwater water table. Break it down for our listeners. What I thought we just had to worry about the rivers overflowing, but man, you gave me something else to worry about.
Well, I know I don't want to add more things to your plate. You and Debbie worry about enough, so I don't want to cause any stress for any of you. But the truth is, we not only are dealing with surface water, which is what we see the snow, we see the rivers, we see the runoff, but a lot of times the danger that we don't see is the actual groundwater beneath our homes. And so some people live on very sandy soil and they've never really had any kind of water table issues, while other people might live on clay or live out in a flat area or perhaps a brand new area that has never really been tested in the sense of a high water table or a really wet year. So if you've had a home that's been built in an area that's new in the last 5 or 10 years, your home has only experienced drought conditions. You've never had above normal water tables because in the last 10 years, we haven't experienced that here in Utah. So what can happen is if you're building in areas that have had a lake bed there or have had otherwise water, swampy, soggy kind of things, there's a potential for the water to come up, and that can cause all sorts of problems in a home.
Kevin Eubank, KSL meteorologist, a.k.a. Debbie Downer, joining us live on the line. And, you know, I gotta pass the baton to you sometimes, Kev, because now I am worried about our listeners who live in certain areas. And I want you to pinpoint some of those areas that you have just zeroed in on as potential for groundwater flooding.
Well, let's anywhere in western Davis County that's near the Great Salt Lake, anywhere over in northern Tooele County, which is near the Great Salt Lake. So Grantsville, Stockton, Tooele, Foxborough and Davis County, Syracuse and far west, and anywhere there are these new developments around the lake's eventually going to come up, right? And the water tables. Now, a lot of municipalities have said, and if your builder or your municipality has said, you can't have a basement. The reason for that is because there's an area that's prone to a high water table. That's just the way it works. So they make you do a crawl space or they make you do some other things. And the reason for that is as the water table comes up, water tends to rise and start coming up to the surface. If you put a basement underground, all of a sudden that water's got to come up and it starts coming up from underneath your slab. And so you have to put some pumps in. You got to cause, you know, a lot of mitigation to get that water out. So I'm not saying that's going to happen. I'm just saying that when we flip the cycle and we start getting water years like this, that absolutely becomes a problem. And that's a different kind of scenario. So I would just suggest, and I don't sell insurance, I don't have anything to do with any of that, but you better check with your homeowners and home insurance to figure out, does groundwater count as flooding? Does that infiltration of water in my home? And you may want to consider a flood policy to cover those kinds of things, because those kinds of things are going to happen in the coming year and years as we see more stormy patterns like the one we're in.
So is this from the snow and the rain, everything, it's melting, it's seeping into the ground, and is it oversaturating the ground? Is that essentially what's happening, or is it coming from even deeper?
Well, it's both, Dave. So we talked about earlier, right, that some municipalities are saying, hey, we're gonna let this water go in and start recharging the aquifer underneath. The ground needs to be recharged. So when you put a lot of water in the ground, that water table comes up. And so as the ground gets saturated, depending on your soil type, all of a sudden that water starts to creep up and you get what's called the higher water table. So it does happen deep, and it does happen on a not so deep level in the 20 to 30 feet below your house. So as the water table rises, as the ground gets more saturated, when there's buildings, when there's structures, when there's low spots, those become areas of emphasis and concern for water gathering. And we see it on the surface, and we can handle it mentally on the surface because we can see where it goes. We know where the water goes. You dig a trench, you move the water, you get rid of it. But under your house, oh, that is I've been in scenarios where it comes up, and all of a sudden you're like, there's water in my basement. My brand new refinished basement has water in the carpet. Where's it coming from? And I literally watched a contractor do a core drill into a cement floor, and a geyser came out from that hole of water that had been collected and pressurized under the slab. Wow. And all of a sudden, all that water was wanting to come up, and the house was in its way.
That is an incredible story. Kevin Eubank, thank you. Something that I hadn't thought of until we spoke yesterday. So thanks for that. No, but it's great information, Deb. It's something that I think we need to be aware of. It was a great explanation. If all of a sudden water is ending up in your basement and you're not quite sure where it's coming from, think about maybe it's coming from the groundwater.
I'm thinking about calling my insurance agent once we walk off the show to see if groundwater qualifies for flood insurance. It's kind of flooding from a different area. When you think of flooding, you think of it pouring out of the rivers or, down the street and into your basement. But this is coming up, sneaking up from the ground.
And as we talked to Matt Gephardt recently, who's done a lot of stories on insurance, he says typically when you're talking about flooding, anything that comes from the roof, anything that comes from above is covered by insurance. So if you have a leaky roof, if something happens that way, covered. As soon as it hits the ground and the flooding occurs, then typically, again, insurance does not cover that. So I think it's an important conversation to have with your insurance person.
Next, this one is straight from the D2 Complaint Department. Dave Noriega, also a.k.a. Mr. Public Transit for years, using the Front Runner train to get to work, as he should. But I've noticed that lately things have been tapering off if you've been driving the truck in more and more because of why?
Delays, delays, delays.
Are you losing your love affair with UTA?
And I'm not alone. In fact, you can look at just about any survey that is done. When people fall out of love with public transit, it's almost always because of delays, delays, delays.
Dave and Dujanovic.
Dave Noriega, Mr. Public Transit. For years, you've used FrontRunner to get to work and go back home. But you're not alone in this. Something has happened lately that has kind of forced you in a direction to break up with public transit.
Yeah, it's a slow breakup, but I'm telling you, we're going through a rocky patch right
now. What's going
on? Delays, delays, cancellations, cold weather. And Debbie, I don't have a terrible commute. Like when I take my car, 25 minutes. That's how long it takes me to get to work. When I take the train, it's 45 minutes. So it's a little bit longer, but I love it. It saves me a ton on gas. I love when somebody else drives and I can just do my own thing while I'm riding the train. I love that. But I've run into some significant delays lately. And when it is 15 degrees outside or below, it is a miserable, miserable experience.
We branched out our research. The D2 research department went down the rabbit hole, the World Wide Web, and we found several articles from EcoLane to Forbes. And it's pretty consistent. The number one reason people give up on public transit is the reason that you're teetering on whether to continue to take it, and that is delays.
Yeah, delays. And I don't expect public transit to be perfect. And maybe it's just a bad stretch. It's not realistic to expect everything to be on time every single time. But I went through a couple-week stretch, 2-3 weeks, where there were 15, 30 hour-long delays. At 6 a.m., 15 degrees outside. I think I texted this to you one morning, 6:15. The train lost power in the cabins, no heating. We had to get off the train. We are all just freezing because we're not dressed for 10 to 15 degree weather, and we have to wait for the other train to come.
No outdoor heaters?
No outdoor heaters.
Any alerts giving you updates on social media?
No. I follow Twitter, the Ride UTA feed, and there was no update on this. So it's kind of hit and miss sometimes on social media. And I looked recently to some of the reasons why there are delays, and it's train swap issues, mechanical issues, police activity. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of things that can disrupt service, and it again has me kind of questioning, do I want to keep messing with it?
Jay Fox, Executive Director of the Utah Transit Authority. Good morning. Let's save this relationship between Dave and Front Runner. I tend to like it more when he heads in on the train because he does research for the show when he's on the train. So do you think Dave just hit a bad stretch on Front Runner? Or are you seeing this same concern from other riders?
Well, hey, good morning to you both, and thank you for having me on the show. So Dave and I are in the same boat. We take the same mode to work every day, so I'm on Front Runner as well. So you do have a bit, I will admit that you've had a bit of a bad stretch these last 2 months. In 2022, we were over 90% on time for Front Runner, which is stellar. I mean, way above the national average for commuter rail. And in fact, in December, we had a terrible weather month, and we were over 90% on time. So we've been reliable. Well, I think, so Dave, you mentioned we did have a couple, but we're always really low on the what we call agency responsible delays. We've had a number of third party delays. So, you know, you mentioned police activity. Those things are often beyond our control. I would say that most of the time it's somebody, stepping, into our alignment. And that can be a very unfortunate thing. And that will back up the system very quickly.
Yeah.
And there's something that we're doing about that is very, very large and big, but which I can talk about. But I think you're seeing a little bit of a bad patch for January and February. We've had an unusual number of third-party delays.
You know, and if this was in the middle of July when it's warm,
right,
and the weather's great outside, I probably would be a little more forgiving. When it's 15 degrees and I've got a light jacket on, I'm just miserable.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know, and I get it. You're not unlike me if all of a sudden you're forced out of a train. But that would only be for an agency responsible delay. The third party delays, unfortunately, you still got the comfort of being inside the vehicle, but you're gonna be sitting there because, you know, the police have to take care of whatever they need to do, or you know, we've got to clear a crossing, or we had a UP issue earlier this year with a derailment up in Ogden. So those things, we just have to wait to clear.
Jay Fox, Executive Director of UTA, live on the line with us. And this, let's take this all with a little bit of a grain of salt. This from the man who spent 2 days this week in traffic.
So true.
Because of snowstorms
I
and
start
traffic
driving.
Accidents.
Yeah,
got
awful
to work at about 8:30 one morning because I didn't even know if he was going to make it. He was so stuck in traffic driving the truck in. So take, you know.
I'm the human jinx.
Front Runner would have been the better route those 2 days. But you just said something about that piqued my interest. You said I could talk about something that's big and large that's going to be happening if you want me to. Well, I want you to. What is it?
So right now, one of the reasons we're so subject to potential delays and why it affects us greatly is because we only have 25% double tracking, which means that, you know, we have to hit our meets. Trains going north and south, they have to meet at very specific times. The moment one of them is even slightly delayed, it throws off the whole system. We are engaged with a project with the Utah Department of Transportation where we're going to double the amount of double tracking so that our system, when we're done, will have 50% double tracking. That's going to do a number of things for us. One, that which is the best thing for Dave and for me, is it's going to allow us to have 15-minute service at the peak. So it means that the train's going to come every 15 minutes, which means, Dave, you and I are going to have to spend less time on that platform and more time in the train. And if somebody's pulling up and the train's pulling away, it means that they only have 14 minutes till the next train arrives. So that's huge. And the second thing about that is the more double track we have, the more opportunity we have to maintain our system during the week, because we can't do that right now. We have to do it on Sunday. What does that mean? It means Sunday service. Sunday service would
wow
be just awesome for the region, because when we do have our occasional Sunday service, like we had for NBA All-Star Weekend, man, does it pop. And so this is a big project that UDOT and UTA are engaged with. The state has put a tremendous amount of money on this, and and President Biden just put this project in his budget as part of the Federal Transit Administration's Capital Investment Grant Program. So there's a lot of money coming the way for this project, and we're really, really excited about it, because it's going to make a huge difference for those people who use Front Runner.
I'm going to be honest. This was some good marriage counseling. I needed this. This was good for me. I do. I appreciate it. Hey, I've got 15 seconds, but I do want to know, what's the best way to track whether or not your train, tracks, bus is on time? And is there any way I could track the train in real time? Because that would be amazing.
Yeah. So if you use our transit app, so we have a third party app called Transit, and that you actually literally can see where the train is using that app. In fact, what I do, Dave, is I'm actually in my car until I see that the train's approaching. So that's the way I make sure I keep warm. And also, if you go to our website, the first thing that's going to pop up is sign up for service alerts, so that you can get it by email, text. And of course, you signed up for Twitter. I apologize if there was a failure in Twitter, but certainly the email and text alerts will come directly to you because there are people out there that don't want to use Twitter.
I love me some public transit hacks. Thank you so much for joining us. Jay Fox, Executive Director of UTA.
Did we save the marriage, Dave?
Yeah, yeah. No, I think I'm ready. I think I'm ready to go back.
Well, I think after your commute in the truck this week, especially the one, what day was it that you were stuck? I thought you weren't even going to make the show.
Oh,
you were stuck on Legacy.
It was locked down for an hour. And I sent you a picture where I'm like 0.8 gallons remaining. Like, I'm going to run out. I'm going to freeze to death.
The text was, is this a bad thing?
Is this a bad thing? Like, lights are flashing. See, gasoline is out.
If you were on Front Runner, you wouldn't have had to worry about any of that.
So you're right.
You got to give the relationship another chance, right? Saving the relationship one talk discussion at a time here on the Dave and Dujanovic Show. Straight ahead, speaking of apps, this one's a different app. We're going to go inside how it works and how it helped get information to Spanish Fork High School teachers when things were breaking down into chaos yesterday during that hoax.
Ironically, they just launched an app a week ago today that all of the staff at the school had been trained on how to use to communicate if something like this were to happen. And that app came in handy at this moment. Fortunately, it turned out to be a hoax.
Dave and Dujanovic. Special coverage of the top local story.
I sat in my office and cried, and I thought, I am so grateful that things ended the way they did, but had they not, I don't know if I could teach anymore.
Continuing to take you inside what we have learned since a series of hoaxes went out yesterday to 13 schools, calls to 911 about a fake active shooter in, you know, multiple schools all over Utah. That was Andy Hunsaker. He's a theater teacher at Spanish Fork High School, speaking to KSL5 television about his experience during yesterday's hoax. And Dave, you had somebody you know really well texting you during this show who was also at Spanish Fork.
Yeah, and it was kind of a strange situation because Dustin Smith, who's the head football coach for Spanish Fork, said he was driving kind of in the area when he saw a bunch of police just speeding toward the school. Well, because he's, you know, the head football coach, he's got a ton of kids that he's over there, and he's got, I think, some of his own children there. He just followed the police. He just followed them to Spanish Fork High School, and he saw them go in with their tactical gear, their long rifles. And it was a scary situation because nobody knows what's going on. But he told us about some of the training that had been going on at Spanish Fork High School. And they have recently begun using an app so that if there is a situation, an active shooter situation, they all have access. The teachers, the administrators have access to this app.
Ironically, they just launched an app a week ago today that all of the staff at the school had been trained on how to use to communicate if something like this were to happen. And that app came in handy at this moment. Fortunately, it turned out to be a hoax.
Lana Hiskey is the Communications and Community Relations Administrator for the Nebo School District. Lana, thanks for joining us. Can you tell us more about this app?
You bet. And you're exactly right. Just a week ago yesterday, all of Spanish Fork staff was trained on this app. It's called DIR-F. That stands for Disaster Incident Report and Security. And it's an app that we're just piloting right now at Spanish Fork High. Spanish Fork High is a unique situation because there's a lot of buildings at that high school. So it's very helpful to have this app and be able to reach all staff immediately.
Lana Hiskey, Communications Director at the Nebo School District, live on the line, specifically talking about what took place yesterday at Spanish Fork High School as they were responding to this hoax threat of an active shooter. It was Spanish Fork and 12 other schools in Utah that were getting these threats yesterday morning. Started happening during our show, and that's when the head football coach called in, had been texting Dave to say, yeah, I'm here, and we put him on the air, and he told us about this app. So take us inside the app, Lana. How does it work?
Okay, so we actually didn't get the call. Dispatch got the call. And so our administration team, the first they knew of this situation yesterday was when police officers, all in their gear, like you said, with guns, were coming into the front door and let them know that there were people down and there was an active shooter in the school. Thank heavens, we now know that was a hoax. But at the time, our administration went right to the app and there's an alert. He hit the alert button, and that sent an alert to every teacher and staff to do what we call a lockdown. That's lock everyone in place, lock doors, hide behind what you can, and stay quiet. And so that alert went out. The cool thing about this app that we're finding, once he hit that app, then teachers hit a button back saying, we're all safe, or we're unsafe. So red means we're unsafe and green means we're safe. He watched classroom by classroom green lights light up. And he said it did his heart really good, you know, to sit and watch all those green lights come back. And then he had a red light. And so there's a chat feature on this app, and he chatted to the teacher and said, hey, are you okay? And the teacher responded immediately back and said, sorry, I hit the wrong button. Yes, we're safe. And then changed it to green.
All the times to hit the wrong buttons, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, and it can happen when you're nervous and you know that this could be the real deal. And so anyway, it was so nice to have that chat feature. There's also the feature that they could hurry and change it. But they had communicated, you know, quickly, and then she changed it. Another thing that's – oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just wondering, does the school have physical alerts as well? So does an alarm go off? Does it a fire alarm type thing happen so everybody knows? Or is it just through the app?
With this, it was with the app. There's also, you know, a PA system. There's also an alarm. But you have to also remember that kids could be out in the PE building. They could be walking in between classes. They could be, you know, in lots of different places, maybe the lunchroom, you know, just places where they would not hear or didn't hear because they were laughing or, you know, and that has happened. I've actually watched that happen before. So this app that actually alerts the staff member, and it is a sound as well, it just went out immediately, no matter where they were. Another thing on this app that we really liked yesterday was, we had a teacher chat in and say, hey, I'm missing Johnny. Now, of course, that's not his real name. I'm missing Johnny, not in my classroom. Can you find him? One of the administrators happened to be walking down the hall and said, yeah, there's Johnny. I've got Johnny. I'll bring him in. So, you know, that was extremely helpful.
She's just making, quote unquote, Johnny, making sure Johnny's safe, right? I mean, it's like I'm missing a child. Right. Has anybody seeing this child, which is amazing. So why is this still a pilot? Today it sounds like it should be in all schools by this afternoon, Lana. It's just my opinion.
You know, what we know so far, I agree with you. We are actually going to be piloting it and another school very, very soon. So, yeah, we're excited about it so far. We need to make sure that it is what it seems to be. I had a debriefing today with our Spanish Fork first responders. That included, you know, the hospital, the law enforcement, fire, EMTs, ambulance. We all met this morning, had debriefing today. One of the officers there pulled me aside later and just said, hey, I want you to know I'm on that app. So we have some of our local officers on that app as well so that they know if we've got an emergency at the school. And he was very impressed because he could also watch green, 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 we're safe. And he wasn't even in Spanish Fork. He was down in St. George. So he loved that. Now, you know, we have a great relationship with our law enforcement, and we also have radios between each other so that we have multiple ways to communicate. This is just a new way that we're trying, and it seems to be working.
Well, we're sorry you had to use it, but also grateful that it worked as you had hoped. Best case scenario. Lana Hiskey, thank you for joining us from the Nebo School District.
Yeah, that's from the sounds of it, that's quick. It's impressive. And as you and I have talked about many times, privately and publicly, who doesn't ever have their phone with them?
Right.
I mean, I did dare to walk away from my desk for a few minutes this morning without my phone. But the moment I walked away, I was like, where's my phone? You're right. So so this sounds like a fabulous way to get that. And then the green lights lighting up and then knowing that one teacher accidentally pushed the red button, but then was able to correct it. This is fascinating.
Yeah, very interesting. It's a pilot program being used in Spanish Fork High School. The Nebo School District is checking it out, but it really sounds like an interesting way to quickly reach out to everybody and have them, you know, almost in a group chat feature, but way better organized than a group chat feature to communicate whether or not you're safe.
In the 11 o'clock hour, we're going to go in depth with psychiatrist Dr. Hans Watson on the different reactions that kids had to this. Some just, you know, didn't think it was any big deal, and others, you know, were obviously very shaken. So we're going to walk through that and, you know, how to deal with your child's emotions after a day like yesterday. Although some kids are saying, you know, it's concerning, will that happen again? But we're also excited about getting back to school today. So that is in our 11 o'clock hour. And straight ahead, we're going to go to take you to New York, wondering what in the world is happening with the grand jury in the case of Mr. President Trump and the investigation into those hush payments that were made. That's next.
Dave and Dejanovic, your morning companions for talk, analysis, and key perspectives on Utah's biggest stories on KSL News Radio.
Let's turn the time over now to Dan Rascone of KSL 5 TV. Dan, you have put together a special for KSL 5 television during General Conference weekend this weekend, and we're excited to learn more about it. And it has to do with a Utah connection to what happened in Uvalde, Texas last May.
Yeah, that's correct. Good morning, guys. We all remember that awful scene from May 24th last year, Uvalde, Texas, where a lone gunman went into the school and killed 19 kids and two teachers. Just a horrific thing, you know, and especially with what we're seeing today. But there was a Utah artist that saw what happened there and wanted to help out in some way. Well, he had a brother-in-law that just so happened to live in Uvalde and called him and said, hey, would you be interested in painting portraits of every one of these children and these two teachers and then giving them to the families? And this artist was just moved by this, and that's exactly what he wanted to do. J.R. Johansson, 78 years old. He lives in Huntsville. He has a little backyard studio, and for years now he's been painting missionaries who have passed away while serving, and he's done over 150 missionaries, and just really some tender moments there that he does it all for free, and he wanted to do it for these victims of the Uvalde, Texas. And so we were able to follow him down as he basically went down there with the portraits in hand, all boxed up, and then delivered them and you know, met with the families face to face and gave them these portraits. And there were some very tender moments there. And so this is what our documentary, it's called Uvalde Angels, and it airs this Sunday at noon on KSL. But just a very, some very That's tender amazing. Moments seeing this Utah artist.
Well,
do this.
And here's just a short clip from one of the moms. This mom lost her 10-year-old daughter named McKenna.
The picture that he used to do this painting was taken last year at Halloween. She wanted to be a cheerleader. What strikes me the most about this picture is her eyes. They were the most beautiful hazel, and you really captured it.
Dan, I would imagine it's tough to receive this gift because it simultaneously brings up a lot of sad emotions, remembering that they've been taken from you, but at the same time, what a wonderful way to remember them as well. I would imagine there's a lot of conflicting emotions there.
There really is. And you know, we were there almost 8 months to the day of their anniversary of this tragedy. And so obviously hearts were very tender. These families have been, you know, comforted by the community, and many people have reached out with many different ways to be able to do something like this. From what we understood, this was really the first time that a professional portrait artist had been able to put together this many photos for every one of the families. And it was just a really neat thing to be able to see them grateful to be able to have something that they could hang up in their homes. And yeah, there's conflicting emotions there, but at the same time, there was some very comforting moments and some hope from families.
Dan, remind us when the documentary airs on KSL 5 TV.
It airs this Sunday at noon, right after the first session of General Conference. And it's called Uvalde Angels, and it's a 30-minute documentary. And we really go behind the scenes here as we follow J.R. Johansen down to Uvalde, Texas, to deliver these portraits.
Dan Rescone, we look forward to it. Thank you for joining us.
Of course, our coverage here of the 193rd Annual General Conference of the Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints begins Saturday morning at 9:30 right here on KSL News Radio. And we have lots of special coverage as well throughout the day.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news. Dave and Dujanovic have inside sources.
Looking forward, as we always do at this time, for our conversation with Boyd Matheson from Inside Sources. I was listening to you yesterday on my drive home. Always a fascinating perspective, Boyd. During your show. He's also going to be joining us for some special coverage this weekend as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints launches its 193rd Annual General Conference. Boyd has some special coverage to talk about in just a moment. But before we get to that, we want to go back to a discussion we had yesterday about the 2024 presidential campaign and potential candidates. And I'm not 100. Was this yesterday or a couple
yeah,
of days ago?
Yeah.
My goodness. Yesterday was such a blur because of what was going on
yeah.
with all the schools.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Here we are. It was yesterday. Okay, thanks.
Well, you'll remember as we were talking about 2024 candidates, we were talking about Ron DeSantis and really how he is, as far as the polls are concerned, the next best possibility to Donald Trump. The only other two that were really even registering was Nikki Haley and Mike Pence. But you have a dark horse candidate for us.
And this is not the first time you've brought his name up.
Yeah, he is. I think he is going to get in the race. And all the indications are probably in the next 2 weeks that Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina will enter the presidential race. And he is just an extraordinary soul. I've interviewed him several times. I worked with him when I was back in Washington, D.C. He was a new senator at the time from South Carolina. And he just has an amazing story. His personal biography is called From Cotton to Congress. His grandfather worked in the cotton fields. And to see that in just that short a time frame, for him to go from that story to being raised by a single mother in his grandparents' home to becoming a member of Congress and now potentially a candidate for president is a pretty extraordinary story.
Well, your eyes are lighting up when you're talking about him. It's not the same kind of eyes light up look that you had yesterday when we were talking about Ron DeSantis. So what does that say?
So the one thing
what are you telling us?
The one thing you need to know about Senator Scott is he is a happy warrior and he is someone who understands community. It's part of the reason I included my conversation with him in the special coming up on Sunday, which is because he understands that we've got this all backwards. If we're all about politics and platforms for people to go after this idea of power instead of the power of ideas, that's where we get it wrong. He has a very different view in terms of what leadership is and what stewardship means at the highest levels.
And so for those of us who are faith-filled, we are flawed. We need help, but we never leave our faith behind because ultimately it's my faith that makes me want to be a servant more than a leader. It's my faith that teaches me to look for those who are underserved and not just to friends. It's my faith that reminds me that I too need a savior and I can at the very least be the hands and feet of the good Lord in a tangible way. But I should never mistake my responsibility to my faith with telling you what you must believe.
Well, and I think as I listen to him, obviously wears his faith on his sleeve.
Yeah.
It's a big part of him. How does that translate? How do you bring that into Washington, D.C., and how do you take it into politics without it becoming a lightning rod?
Yeah, so if you look at that, and if you look at his Facebook posts, he's regularly, you know, posting about not just his faith, but all kinds of faith. And he really believes that faith in America really begins with faith in America. It's faith in the public square. It's in our communities and in our homes, whatever that might be. And so for him, it's less about telling you, hey, I believe this and you need to believe that, or this is good and that's bad. It's more this idea that, look, there's a set of principles that make a real difference. And when you go from trying to be the leader or the boss to being a servant and a steward, you approach everything in public policy differently. And that's the conversation he's trying to say. And the other thing I think that he would do if he does get in is that he will show that, look, we are a flawed country. We have our problems. We have all kinds of things we need to fix and do better. But the solutions to that are not coming out of Washington, D.C. He's going to push more power back to the states. And so it's a very optimistic, very hopeful. I've listened to him speak on so many times. I'd go to his church any day because it's just faith-filled, hope field, and so different from a lot of the grievance politics that we've been experiencing over the last decade, really.
Our coverage here at KSL News Radio of the 193rd Annual General Conference of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints begins Saturday morning at 9:30 with Maria Chaleos, and then it bridges into the 10 a.m. to noon session, the morning session on Saturday. And as I'm looking over our long list of special coverage, many documentaries that we've been working on here at KSL News Radio, includes yours, which airs noon to 1 on Sunday, right after the morning session on Sunday. The Beloved Community, Recognizing and Elevating the Interconnectedness of Our Lives. And I'm seeing here, just on the synopsis, Boyd, it begins with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. often spoke about the need to create the beloved community.
Yeah, and that is what it's all about. He said the end is not power, it's not politics. The end is the beloved community, where we value the differences and respect the differences and celebrate the differences. And rather than focusing just on that, we focus on what actually unites us, not just the differences. And so we have a really broad brush conversation with leaders from faith groups, from politics, from business. One of my favorite is the new Episcopal Bishop, Phyllis Spiegel, here in the Utah Episcopal Church. You want to talk about someone who will light your world up. She may be my favorite disciple anywhere on the planet because she talked about the need for us to be connected and to look out for each other in the community and not just those that are struggling.
Out of the last 3 years, isolation's been a huge word. Well, let's put community in place of that. Let's really build up who are the needs of others, whose needs are not being seen. And when we think about that, that's not always people who are unhoused or the people who are below poverty line. We think about those neighbors, but also we have neighbors who are isolated through age or illness or their family doesn't live near them. So building community, it's the way we know God.
That beloved community doesn't happen in isolation. It requires all of us to look out. And again, it's not just for those that are in poverty. It's not just for those that are unhoused or addicted. It's that person, your next door neighbor. It's getting to know the people on your street who may be isolated because of age or because of illness or other circumstances. And it really requires all of us this change. So often we look to Washington. The focus on our special at noon on Sunday is really all about what do each of us need to do individually. And I'll close you with really what captured my idea on all of this from Dr. Martin Luther King. He says, our goal is to create a beloved community. And this will require a qualitative change in our souls as well as a quantitative change in our lives. The answers aren't coming from Washington. We all need to look in the mirror and then link arms and do this thing together.
Boyd, we look forward to that special. Thank you for joining us. Inside Sources today from 1 to 3.
And you'll be on noon to 1 on Sunday, so I'll look forward to listening then. Thanks so much, Boyd. Straight ahead, Utah's making big waves across the nation with our new social media law that restricts kids' use of social media. We're going to take a dive into that in a moment.
We're going to look back 10 years from now and think, what did we do? We destroyed a generation of kids with this stuff.
Dave and Dujanovic. Dave and Dujanovic. Special coverage of the top local story.
The state of Utah, we have been making some pretty big waves on the national news scene for a social media law that passed this year during the general session of the Utah State Legislature. The New York Times spent 30 minutes.
On us.
Yeah. And then I look up, was it Sunday? And there's Governor Cox on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd.
And we know this is killing our kids. We have to start there. The harm being done to our children far outweighs. And again, this started well before COVID. Since 2012, especially among young women, the rates of suicide, depression, anxiety, self-harm have skyrocketed. And every research institution that has looked at this is pointing to social media as the cause.
So we're going to dive in and describe what this law means and how it is applied. I think this kind of falls in the social media is bad. I'm not quite sure what to do, but let's do something. Let's throw this spaghetti against the wall, see if it sticks.
All right, let's go through some of the ins and outs of this new law. It will require social media companies to verify the age of the Utah resident seeking to open or maintain an account.
How do we protect data privacy? I suspect as we look at this that there will be third-party age verification companies that we will utilize to make this happen. We also don't want – we've seen the leaks that have happened with some of these social media companies. We don't want them having copies of driver's licenses on hand. That's not what we're trying to do here. We believe that there are technological fixes that we can work around this. And that's what we'll be working on over the course of the next year.
Well, I guess a social media company could just look at a selfie of me and count the fine lines and wrinkles. and know that I'm not under the age of 18. I don't know how that works. I mean, what are we uploading and sending and that we don't want hacked? So I'm not quite clear on that aspect of it.
Well, it does address a little bit of what I think the biggest problem with social media is, which is anonymous accounts. I think anonymous accounts are the worst possible thing on social media. It allows people to be toxic. They aren't ever held accountable for the words that they say. So the idea of verifying an age, verifying an account to a user, I think that is a great step forward.
As we wind our way through the new law, and in a moment we're going to bring somebody into the conversation, I don't think she's necessarily sold on this new law. So we're going to get the other side of this as well. Get consent of a parent or guardian for the users who are under 18. So there
permission.
You go, Dave.
Yep.
I don't have that situation in my house anymore, but you'll be all over that.
Our kids already have that. They have to ask our permission to download accounts. So I like
Well, you
like
have
that
to give consent
it.
To the social media company right. now. Now yep. it doesn't sound like
exactly.
your
Not just
consent
the phone.
That you've got. Yeah, the phone isn't going to apply there. Create curfew settings that blocks access overnight.
My goodness, I need this.
You do.
I need this.
You do. And I did this on my own as a parent. I didn't need the social media company. My kids parked their phones at night on the kitchen counter. It worked out really, really well. So,
yeah, I don't turn mine in. I don't turn one into my wife. Here,
so,
honey, we can take this.
So this law would block underage accounts from certain search results. You probably have a better interpretation of what that means. Exactly.
Yeah, that's great. If kids want to get into some edgy stuff or some inappropriate stuff, it blocks that because they know how old you are. So it's illegal to look at pornography, I think, before you're 18. This would block some of that.
And then Governor Cox also said the social media company cannot collect a child's data.
Brains are developing. It's crazy. Listen, Chuck, there is no other industry where we allow 14-year-olds to contract with major corporations to use their data for anything they want. We just don't do this. We're going to look back 10 years from now and think, what did we do? We destroyed a generation of kids with this stuff.
Sarah Kimmel joins us right now, founder of Family Tech Zone. Sarah, thanks for joining us. What are your thoughts on this? What are some of the concerns you have about the new Utah law?
Sure. I mean, you've already touched on at least my very first one is the privacy issues. I think a lot of adults in Utah kind of see this as, oh, okay, well, I don't have any kids, so I can ignore this law. But no, they can't. Everybody in Utah will have to verify their age come March 2024. And whether, you know, the bill doesn't exactly say how they have to get those age verifications, but it does say it's not, you know, maybe government issued ID. And like he said, there's going to be a database somewhere of everybody's driver's license or any type of government issued ID. And I think that's just a really dangerous database to have out there. You know, the greatest security in the world might not stop a lot of hackers.
Sarah Kimmel is the founder of Family Tech Zone on the line with us live as the state of Utah is making national headlines with the new law that kicks in regarding social media and, you know, showing and verifying your age to the social media companies. We don't know what that's going to look like yet. We also don't know about this, Sarah. Stand by.
It's going to be tough, and we don't expect that we're going to be able to prevent every young person from getting around this. Kids are really smart. That's one of the problems.
We don't know how the state of Utah intends to enforce this law yet.
Right. Well, it would be up to the social media companies to to create these stipulations that would only affect Utah. So a couple of things I can foresee happening is, like he said, kids are smart. They already use VPNs to get around their school's restrictions, like the school has restrictions on their Wi-Fi. So they install a VPN to get around that. If you install a VPN, suddenly your phone isn't resident in Utah anymore, and you can have access to all of it.
I have felt, and I said this earlier, it falls a little bit under the, I'm not sure what to do, but let's just do something and figure it out along the way. We have done nothing for a very long time, and we have seen the negative effects social media has had on our kids, on ourselves, on our own lives. If this isn't it, is there any restriction that is more reasonable?
You know, I do think that there is something we can do, and that's not outside of the government's reach, and that's to eliminate phones in schools. They can bring their phone but not use their phone inside the school, and that's well within the government's jurisdiction. And I think that will do so much more to kind of curtail this problem than trying to parent everyone's kids at home.
Well, and they tried that. A lawmaker tried that this year, and it got really nowhere on Capitol Hill, but this legislation did. And I also wonder, Sarah, if this isn't just something that just falls within a parent's purview to put the restrictions on the phone, to monitor how often the phone is used, and to find out, you know, make sure you're looking at it to see what websites or social media sites your child is visiting.
Right. And like Dave already said, half of these things are things parents can already implement themselves. So you can put a time limit and put a bedtime on your kids' phones. You can have consent to let them open an account. You know, you can monitor what apps they're installing and what apps they're using. So a lot of this you can already do as a parent. So why is the government trying to tell the parents how to do it?
Sarah Kimmel, thank you for your perspective, your insight. I thought a really interesting conversation. Thank you for joining us, a founder of Family Tech Zone.
We know that President Biden, during his State of the Union, called for bipartisan legislation at the federal level to protect kids online.
It's time to pass bipartisan legislation to stop big tech from collecting personal data on our kids and teenagers online.
I mean, does this fly in the face of that, though? Because won't big tech be collecting personal data on our kids' age?
They're going to use a third party, Deb. Don't worry about it. No, the federal government said they want to do something. They haven't, which is why Governor Cox said the states need to lead out on this and kind of force the federal government to find a consistent set of rules. Now, here's an idea I thought that was really, really interesting. We just got it from one of our producers, Gustavo. And, Goose, you told us in Mexico, you have to prepay to use social media. That's amazing. Prepay?
Are you jumping on the microphone, Gustavo? Yeah, he's being a little bit shy. We're going to get him on the air. Did you prepay so you could use social media when you were there the last time you went to Mexico with your family? And do your family members who live there, do they prepay?
So my family does. I don't, because since I'm coming from the U.S., I have my plan down there. So, but they have to prepay to use Instagram, WhatsApp, Twitter, Facebook, and all that
every
stuff.
Time?
Every time. If they run out of minutes, they got to go get a card for social media. Or AT&T's down there, so they have to get a plan where they can use Instagram for free for a month, like something like
what,
that.
Like a teaser rate, for a month?
And then after, they got to pay.
Fascinating.
Like a subscription. Like Hulu. Like your Hulu account.
Why are we doing that? Why are we not doing
that? Well, that's a whole other conversation. Thanks, 30 seconds Gus. Before the show ends, Goose, you give us this little nugget of information. It's a great conversation. And I also kind of hate it. So there you have it.
Oh, I'm on the opposite end. I love it.
Dave and DeGenevieve. Dave and DeGenevieve. Special coverage of the top local story.
In just a few minutes, we're going to bring you up to date on what we know so far about the investigation into 13 hoax calls that went out all across Utah. Impacted tons and tons of students and teachers and police departments all over the place. Turned out it was a hoax, but it was still scary for these kids.
It was kind of a lack of information at first, so we kind of just went into it blindly. We actually had to hide in our wood shop, and we were just there waiting for any info, whether that be police coming in or whether that be someone else. You know, you don't know what's happening in there. So,
and part of what made these phone calls so offensive was they were calling as if they were a student in the school hiding out. They reported multiple children were down, again, all a hoax, but it was very descriptive. And this is what triggered all the panic and the chaos of police coming in their tactical gear with their long rifles, going classroom to classroom, trying to find out where this shooter could be.
I saw a video from outside Spanish Fork. It was on a social media post outside of Spanish Fork High. And the person was saying, like, look at this. They're all gathered outside in the football area. We've got cops on top of the bleachers with guns. We've got the kids, you know, obviously trying to keep the kids safe, calling out names so they can reunite them with their parent. And Dr. Hans Watson, we want to bring you into the conversation. Owner of Dynamic Psychiatry. You've actually been on the show with us earlier this week after the Nashville shooting at that elementary school in Nashville. It's just horrific. These threats come on the heels, although they are hoaxes, on the heels of that shooting, which was the real thing. And these kids, our kids across Utah, there's probably all kinds of different emotions, but a lot of them are probably feeling some trauma.
Sure, absolutely. I think you're right.
And it will be different for each of the different children and how they're prepared for this. And so you'll see differing levels. Whereas during the actual event, when they're being in lockdown, you would expect most kids to have a similar level of fear and feelings of being overwhelmed. But it will differ greatly after the event. You will see it differ greatly based on their home environment and their coping.
Dr. Watson, I have a 17-year-old, a junior in high school. He wasn't part of this. He wasn't involved in any way. His school wasn't. But I asked him, I said, you guys run through these kind of trainings, right, where you guys plan for it. And he's like, yeah, we don't take it very seriously. And I wonder what it's like now as you start going through these. Is there a way to impress upon children that don't necessarily take these things very seriously, that this is important stuff?
Yeah, and I think the way that is when the adults take it seriously, that's the best thing you're going to do for a child to see, because ultimately when the real deal starts coming down and it's something you're doing in real life, they will remember how seriously the adults took it back then. And these kids, what you'll see is the kids that have the ability to incorporate opposing views and difficulty and learn through conflict resolution, they're the ones that are going to be able to incorporate it quickly and start to say, this is how I need to respond, because this isn't the single sanitized world that I hope that I get to live in. And the kids who they've been sheltered or they haven't been exposed or possibly living in a virtual world, so it's only the things, they're going to be traumatized through this because they don't know how to incorporate opposing views and things that are scary and work through it. And so you will see a severely different reaction. But ultimately, when the adults take it seriously, when the rubber meets the road, the kids will fall back onto what they have seen. That, and we call it modeling in the psychiatric world.
Dr. Hans Watson, owner of Dynamic Psychiatry, on the line live with us in light of the situation that was happening all morning long yesterday across Utah at many different schools, 13 in total, where hoax calls were phoned into the schools or to 911. I think there was maybe a little bit of both going on with that. But nevertheless, the results still the same all across, and including the teachers. Let me play. This is Andy Hunsaker. He's a theater teacher at Spanish Fork High. Here's what he said about it.
I sat in my office and cried, and I thought, I am so grateful that things ended the way they did. But had they not, I don't know if I could teach anymore.
Okay, they did end well. Nobody got hurt in any of this, but it was still chaotic, Doctor. What is your best piece of advice that you can offer for students, for teachers, for parents who may be still on edge because of what happened yesterday?
The best piece of advice I could give is talk to somebody. Talk it out, because that's the only way we can take our fears and give them a shape. And a fear that is not well-defined and doesn't have a shape grows to something even more than is reality. And so just by talking that out with somebody would be giving it a shape, which makes it less scary and overwhelming. And then if you find that is still disturbing to you, that's when you'd say, okay, I need to seek some professional help to once again help me to resolve some of this, because it's never going to become a good memory. But it can become something that you can work through and realize the chances of this being harmful to me are realistically very low. And so I can continue to function. Whereas if you don't do that reality check and talk about it, it can grow into something that is not as much as reality. In fact, I talk about that in my latest book, Conquering PTSD, that you have to give it shape so that you then can attack what is a real difficulty versus something that is imagined and doesn't have a form, because there's no way to attack that.
Dr. Watson, thank you for joining us. We appreciate your time. And I thought that was insightful, Debbie. I think it is important to talk about it, because oftentimes our minds and our thoughts are so jumbled and so cluttered. When we have to verbalize it, we do have to make a shape out of it. We have to bring them together. And you might realize that either this fear is irrational or it's completely and totally rational and I have to do something about it.
Have you ever thought of it this way? I mean, we so neatly package this up and boil it down to nobody was hurt.
Yeah.
No injuries reported. Everybody was safe. But the reality of it is there might be a lot of emotional baggage that goes, especially our kiddos, you know, who are going through that. And the fact that they don't know for a bit of time, like if everything is safe, we've just come off of this second shooting in a week that was a legit shooting that took lives at two different schools. We had the one in Colorado last week, and then we had the situation in Nashville involving the elementary school kids. And so given the time frame of all of that and the fact that it's on their minds and the media is talking about these two separate incidents and then this happens, what I'm hearing Dr. Hans Watson say is just don't boil it down and package it up.
Yeah,
and
don't
put
minimize
it in a bubble.
It. Right.
Yeah. They're and even teachers as well, school staff who went through that. Things ended well yesterday, right? We can say that.
It comparatively
ended well,
speaking, right?
Yeah, in terms of all the what ifs. But the reality is there was a lot of shock and fear and chaos going on in those moments. So don't ignore those feelings.
Dave and DeGenevieve. Special coverage of the top local story.
If you're just joining us, just jumping in the car, heading out for lunch, I want to bring you up to date on what we have learned so far during the last 3 hours of our show into the investigation, into the hoax threats that put 13 schools across Utah yesterday. It all started during our show on high alert. Forced lockdowns, forced mass police response. Dave, you and I kind of did the loose math on it just moments ago in the break, and we went because we were like, how many people do you think this impacted across Utah?
Yeah, 25,000 kids.
Yeah, I think that's about right. But then you talk about staff, faculty at schools, the school districts, the police officers who came running from all over the areas that they serve. Firefighters responded because just in case there were mass casualties, there was a massive fire response as well with EMTs, dispatchers. I mean, we could go on and on and on. And so I think there are a lot of people listening right now who want to know when they're going to catch the person who did this.
Right.
Right.
And I think what we're learning is initially it sounded like we knew it was a male and we knew that the IP address came from outside of this country. But it's not so simple.
Yeah, we spoke earlier in the show, right out of the gates in the 9 o'clock hour, with the director of communications for the Department of Public Safety, DPS, local PD, FBI, all teaming up to try to track down this person, and she shared quite a bit of information on what they know so far.
Currently, what we were able to find is that all of the calls were made from the same phone number, and as our statewide information and analysis center, along with the FBI, investigated to trace this number, they found that it connected to an IP address that was connecting to outside of the country, not to one specific country. That IP address kind of tagged a couple of different countries. Yet that doesn't necessarily mean that person is outside of the country as well, right? Unfortunately, some of the things that come with technology, as great as it is that people can mask IP address multiple times.
So we wanted to take a deeper dive into that specifically about the masking of the IP address or the masking of your voice. So we talked to Earl Foote from Nexus IT.
Just because you have an IP address, you don't have a smoking gun. More experienced cyber criminals, they will either tunnel to or connect to the voice over IP server where they're making such phone calls from a different location, a different country. IP addresses and MAC addresses can be spoofed, so they can be faked. Even the male voice that was heard could be spoofed by AI or bots.
What we know so far, no arrests yet. They have an IP address. They have basically narrowed it down to a male voice, although we don't know if that was spoofed as well. We know that the Department of Public Safety is working with the FBI, is working with local law enforcement, was all involved in this yesterday, and is also, as we expand the investigation, the scope of it, working with other states as well that were victimized, where students were victimized by these same types of calls this week.
And again, we are not sure if this thing that happened in Massachusetts or Pittsburgh was the same individual, if this is a cabal, if it's a gang, or if it's – we don't know any of that. And that's what they're trying to unpeel and figure out who really is causing this kind of chaos because, as you said, affected probably a couple hundred thousand people in total. It costs millions of dollars in time, energy, resources – to respond to these fake calls.
We also learned that even if this person is out of the country, we talked about this during our show when KSL legal analyst Greg Skordis called in, that there's a real possibility that this person would be extradited. I guess it would depend on what country they are in. It always depends on what country, whether we have an extradition treaty, an agreement
right.
with those countries. But there's also a strong likelihood that the calls were just spoofed to come out of the country. It looked like they're coming from out of the country, but they're actually made from within the United States.
Yeah, it's interesting that Utah was targeted, right? If there was no connection to Utah, then why would somebody from out of state, out of country, pick on us specifically? It doesn't make a lot of sense. So hopefully they'll be able to able to answer some of these questions because it is a head scratcher right now.
I want to turn for just a few minutes to a very special report. Dave and I from noon to one on Saturday with a special called The Webs We Weave, The Psychology of Lying. It airs from noon to one as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints kicks off its 193rd annual general conference. You can hear that live starting at 10 a.m. Actually, our coverage starts at 9:30, but 10 a.m. to noon is the first session Saturday.
And what got us going on this story was Representative George Santos. You'll remember he was elected this past November, flipped a House seat from blue to red in New York. Big win for the Republicans. But it wasn't until after he was elected that we learned that he had lied his way to the top.
Yeah, the resume that he hadn't attended college, that he hadn't worked for some of the major financial companies, the firms that he claimed to work for, that he wasn't Jewish, that he was claimed, he said, no, I was like Jewish. I'm not Jewish. So two aspects of this conversation. The first part of our special dives into lying to get a job or lying at work. So we enlisted the help of retired Special Agent Todd Palmer of the FBI. He was a polygraph examiner for the FBI. He joins us on Saturday.
Everybody does lie. And so if you take that word lie and you really break it down, first off, you have to be honest with yourself about what is a lie. And if you understand what a lie is, it's just asserting something that you believe to be true when in fact it may be untrue or less true. What is the intent and purpose of what it is that they're saying? Is their intent to absolutely deceive you for personal gain or personal benefit? Are they trying to convince you that what they're saying is absolutely true, unequivocally, without any chance of being false, for personal gain? So for me, a lie is something that somebody says that they know is not true for their own personal gain or own personal benefit. They know it's not true. They're trying to convince you that it is because they hope to gain something by what it is that they're saying. I think some people get lost in their own story to the point that they repetitively say things to ingratiate themselves with others, to make themselves look better. So not only do you have to look at what is a lie, but what is the motivation behind the lie?
Yeah. And again, if they say it enough times, do they genuinely believe that lie?
You asked that question.
Yeah.
And he answers that. And we also asked him, is there a way that the general public, like just anybody, can tell if somebody is lying? Like, is there body language that goes along with a lie? And we get into that during our special this Saturday.
Yeah. He says if you're a really good poker player and you can read somebody's tells, then yeah, maybe you can figure out somebody's lying to you. But it's not as easy as they shifted their eyes up and to the left. Therefore, they are lying. It's not that simple, folks.
He'll spell that out for us during our special. We also ask one of our favorite psychologists, Dr. Tom Golightly, to join us for this conversation. So we look at not only lying to get a job or lying in the workplace. We also decided to take it even a step further and say, okay, lying inside the home. What do you do if your kids are lying to you? And what is their purpose or their motivation behind the lie? It's not what you think. I learned a lot from him. Also, what about your spouse when they lie to you? And what is the best way to respond if you catch somebody inside your home in a lie?
And I learned that you don't shout at the top of your lungs, liar, liar, pants on fire. I learned that. But no, it's actually interesting. Great tips of how to confront somebody that you know is lying to you.
That's noon, Saturday. Hi, Maria. She's up next.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andrea Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.